So I'd like to tell you today about Twin Higgs theories. It's work of, I've been doing over the last 2 years with two different sets of collaborators, Go and Harnick, and Nomura, Papucci, and Perez. To this point in time, we have directly observed the quarks, leptons, and gauge bosons of the Standard Model, and we haven't yet found the Higgs. Now, without the Higgs, the Standard Model is inconsistent because weak gauge boson scattering is not unitary. And current positional electroweak data are in very good agreement with the Standard Model, provided the Higgs mass is less than about 200 GeV. However, any model where electroweak symmetry is broken by a Higgs has to explain why the weak scale is so much lower than the Planck scale, which is the hierarchy problem. And the origin of the hierarchy problem is that the Higgs mass parameter gets these quadratically divergent radiative corrections from gauge interactions, Yukawa interactions, and also the Higgs self-couplings. And so in order to generate the hierarchy between the weak scale and the Planck scale, you need fine-tuning of the radiative corrections against the bare Higgs mass parameter to more than 30 orders of magnitude. So if you want to solve this problem, you require new physics at or close to the weak scale, and you also need this new physics to couple to the Standard Model fields with order one strength. That's because these loops which have to be cancelled all involve interactions which have order one strength. Now, positional electroweak measurements tightly constrain any such new physics, and this leads to the problem which is known as the Lepp paradox, which I'm now going to explain.
Hey,
yeah.
Actually, this question Bill Bardeen would ask. There's no gauge invariant regulator for quadratic convergence, so maybe that's just a fiction. Maybe we shouldn't be worrying about it.
Just because we haven't found one, I would say it doesn't mean that one doesn't exist. I mean, if you take something like dimensional regularization and put in a heavy mass scale, you know,
put in a heavy mass scale
into the theory, which couples to the light to a light particle. What happens is that the mass of the light particle gets radiative corrections which are finite and proportional to the mass of the heavy particle. Now that's a sensible question you can ask, which has a well-defined answer, and that's the way you could see that kind of effect. All right, so to understand the Lepp paradox, let's go back to the fine-tuning problem of the Standard Model. So the Higgs potential in the Standard Model takes this familiar Mexican hat form, and it's easy to minimize this potential and find the electroweak wave and also the mass of the physical Higgs. Now, we can estimate the fine-tuning as the radiative correction divided by the mass parameter both squared. I think this has run out of juice. Is there another one? Oh, I found another one. So we can estimate the fine-tuning as the ratio of the radiatively generated mass squared to the original mass squared. And for a physical Higgs mass of about 200 GeV, which is the positional electroweak upper bound, we can estimate the fine-tuning from the top gauge and Higgs self-couplings. So here's the answer using a naive cutoff lambda. So from the top interactions, the fine-tuning is worse than 10% for a cutoff of greater than 2 TeV. For the gauge interactions, the fine-tuning becomes worse than 10% for a cutoff of more than 6 TeV. And if you look at the Higgs self-couplings, the fine-tuning becomes worse than 10% for a cutoff of more than 5 TeV. So the upshot of the fine-tuning calculation is that unless the standard model is severely fine-tuned, we should expect new physics at or close to a TeV. At the same time, we expect that any new physics which addresses the hierarchy problem will couple to the standard model fields with at least order one strength. So when you integrate out these new states, they are going to generate operators like these, which contribute to positional electroweak observables. And here, the scale lambda, which appears in the denominator, is of order the mass of the new states that we just integrated out. And the fine-tuning argument I just gave you tells you that the mass of these new states, and therefore the scale lambda, must be near the TeV scale. Okay. Now here's the problem. Measurements at LEP have already constrained the scale lambda that appears in these operators to be more than 5 TeV. And this is what's called the LEP paradox. So in other words, the fine-tuning argument is telling you that the scale lambda that appears here should be around a TeV, because that's the mass scale of the particles you integrate out to generate these operators. On the other hand, the bounds on these operators from LEP measurements tell you that lambda has to be at least 5 TeV or more. So there's this contradiction, which is the LEP paradox. So LEP paradox leaves us with three distinct possibilities. All right, go back. I just mean that when you have the covariant derivative, instead of plus minus I, you put plus I. It's a Hermitian conjugate of the So it's not supersymmetric. It's just in the standard model. It's my bad notation. It's not a profound thing. Okay, so the LEP paradox leaves us with three distinct possibilities. So the first possibility is that there is simply no new physics which stabilizes the weak scale below 5 TeV for whatever reason. And the theory is simply fine-tuned at the 2% level, the percent level or worse. Okay, that's definitely a possibility. Now, second possibility is there is new physics below 5 TeV which stabilizes the weak scale, and which does contribute significantly to positional electroweak observables. The consistency with positional electroweak is a consequence of accidental cancellations between these different contributions. In this case, the agreement of the standard model with the data is more or less a coincidence. Okay. The last possibility is there is new physics below 5 TeV, which stabilizes the weak scale, but appears in such a way that it doesn't contribute significantly to positional electroweak. And the way this can happen is if the relevant operators are not generated at tree level, but only at loop order. In my preceding argument, I had assumed that the scale lambda which comes here is of order the mass of the new states. But if in certain classes of models, these operators are only generated at loop order. And so there's an additional loop suppression out here, which would allow the mass of the new states to be lower. And in fact, that's actually what happens in supersymmetry. So we know at least one example where this happens. Now, any one of these could be the resolution of the problem. But since the Large Hadron Collider is not expected to be able to probe scales significantly higher than 5 TeV, probably the most pragmatic approach is to search for new models which fall into this third category. Because these are the ones on which we can, get predictions for, and which tell us what to expect at the LHC. And twin Higgs theories are one such class of models. Now, this is a very aggressive formulation of the LEP paradox. If you talk to different people, they'll formulate the LEP paradox slightly differently. This is a kind of an aggressive formulation. Okay, so twin Higgs theories have an unusual feature which distinguishes them from other solutions to the LEP paradox. Now, as I explained earlier, the biggest contribution to the Higgs mass in the standard model is from the top loop. And this is therefore the leading source of fine-tuning, and you know, this is the expression you get. And so naturalness requires new particles below a TV or so to cancel this. Now here's a folk theorem which has been in our field for about a decade, ever since we realized that the top was really heavy and was the dominant contribution to the fine-tuning of the Higgs mass. And here's how it goes. The new particles which cancel this loop have to be related to the top quark by a symmetry for them to cancel this loop. And since we know the top quark is colored, these new states, which I'm going to call the top partners, will also be colored. Okay. So this is a folk theorem. You can find it in places like Tassi lectures and things like that. Right. There is no proof. Okay. It's just a folk theorem. Now, but this folk theorem is important, and here's why. It's crucially important for the LHC. The reason is that the LHC is a hadron machine, and therefore it has far more reach for colored states than for color singlets. So, you know, the LHC bangs protons together. Protons are filled with glue. So two gluons can fuse and make an off-shell gluon, which can spit out two colored particles. And it doesn't matter whether these colored particles are bosons and fermions, this vortex exists. And therefore, if the top partners are colored, the odds are very good that the LHC will find them. On the other hand, if the top partners are not colored, the reach of the LHC is much less. And therefore, it's not clear that the LHC will find them. Okay. Then it becomes a model-dependent question. So the folk theorem is very good news for the LHC. However, the folk theorem is wrong. Okay. And the reason is that it does not take into account the possibility that the top and the top partners are related only by a discrete symmetry. Okay. And a class of twin Higgs models is the first known counterexample. So what are twin Higgs theories? Twin Higgs theories are realizations of the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson that address the Lapp paradox. They are similar in spirit to little Higgs theories. This is useful if you know what little Higgs theories are. But the underlying mechanism is different. So in any model where the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone boson, the challenge is always the same. You have to explain why the Higgs is light, even though the top Yukawa gauge couplings and Higgs self-couplings have to break any global symmetry with order one strength. Okay. So this is the problem. And to understand this problem, let me give you a specific example and show you how the problem arises. So here's a toy model. Consider a model where the SU2 gauge symmetry of the standard model is enlarged to a global SU3 symmetry with the SU2 subgroup of the global SU3 gauged. Okay. And let me assume that the standard model Higgs is the pseudo-Goldstone boson which arises from the breaking of global SU3 down to SU2. And the reason I'm gauging SU2 rather than the full SU3 is that if I gauge the full SU3, then the Higgs would be eaten. And so, you know, it would just disappear from the theory. So I rather gauge SU2. Okay? Now, SU2, the gauging of SU2 is an explicit breaking of this global SU3. Now, I can parametrize the Goldstone bosons associated with the breaking of the global symmetry in this way. So the Goldstone bosons are in this pi, okay, in this kind of nonlinear sigma model parametrization, where pi has this structure. And if you look at the quantum numbers of this field in this corner, H, it's a doublet under the unbroken SU2. And that's the particle I'm going to identify as the standard model Higgs. So now the interactions of the pseudo-Goldstones are going to arise from this gauge covariant kinetic term. But this d mu, calling it d mu is a little bit of a cheat, because I actually have a zero here, because I only gauged the SU2 subgroup of the SU3. And so the gauge interactions don't have an SU3 invariant form. And as a consequence, these kind of diagrams give the field small h a quadratically divergent mass. And it turns out that this radiatively generated mass, no surprise, is exactly the same as the loop corrections in the standard model. And so you gain no advantage from doing this. Okay. All you have is an explanation of why the tree level value of m squared is small. You don't gain any advantage in regard to the loop corrections. So this is the problem that twin Higgs theories have to solve. Okay. So here's the mechanism. And I'm just going to flat out say what it is, and it will become clear how this works in the context of a specific example. So a twin Higgs theory possesses a discrete symmetry which guarantees that any dimensionful terms in the Higgs potential respect a larger global symmetry. And the standard model Higgs emerges as the pseudo-Goldstone boson associated with the breaking of this global symmetry. What I'm going to show you is this suffices to ensure the absence of one-loop quadratically divergent contributions to the Higgs model. Okay, so let's study an implementation of this idea. So consider a scalar field, capital H, which transforms as a fundamental under a global U4 symmetry. Now the potential for H takes this Mexican hat form, just the same as in the standard model. And it's easy to compute the VEV of H, which I'll call F. Okay. And when H gets a VEV, the U4 symmetry is broken to U3, and you get 7 Goldstone bosons. On the other hand, if you write this theory out in terms of you write H out in terms of real and imaginary fields, okay, you'll actually see that the theory possesses an accidental O8 symmetry, okay, because there is H is complex, so it has 4 real parts and 4 imaginary parts. And when you write it out, you can see that you can rotate any of those 8 fields into each other. So the theory has an accidental O8 symmetry, and this O8 symmetry is broken to O7. And you can think of those 7 Goldstones as coming either from the breaking of U4 to U3 or from the breaking of O8 to O7. Okay. No, I think these are the invariants. There's another invariant.
Two of these you can transform because of an identity
of the polynomial. I think with SUN, the invariants you can form either with raised or lower indices or with the epsilon tensor. Mm-hmm. I think anything else can be reduced into one of these two forms. So now what I'm going to do is to gauge an SU2A cross SU2B subgroup of the global U4. And eventually I'm going to identify SU2A with SU2 left of the standard model, while SU2B is going to correspond to a twin, what I call a twin SU2. So under this gauge symmetry, the 4 components of H break up into 2 components, which are HA, which is the standard model Higgs, and HB, which is going to be called the twin Higgs, okay? And I haven't specified its quantum numbers any more than to say it's a doublet under this twin SU2. So now the Higgs potential is going to receive radiative corrections from gauge fields. And they take this form, and the 7 Goldstone bosons are going to acquire masses because of these radiative corrections. But now I do something. I impose a Z2 symmetry, which I call a twin symmetry, which interchanges A and B, so that GA is equal to GB. And let's call them both G. Then the then the radiative corrections take this particularly simple form. And the point is that this is U4 invariant. Even though it's got this quadratic divergence out front, the whole form is U4 invariant. And so it cannot give a mass to the Goldstones. So what we are seeing is that as a consequence of this simple discrete symmetry, the quadratic terms in the Higgs potential always have to fall into this form. This is guaranteed by the A to B symmetry. And even though the gauge interactions constitute a hard breaking of the global symmetry, right, it's not even a soft, hard breaking of the global symmetry, the Goldstones are prevented from acquiring a quadratically divergent mass.
So, if you ever discuss the matter?
I will. Yeah, but what I'm going to assume is that the approach I'm taking is that what I'm going to discuss is the stabilization up to about 5 TeV. Okay, so I'm going to assume that that mass parameter is of order 5 TeV, and so the approach I'm taking is something like you can think of 5 TeV as a composite in a scale or something like that. And then the positional electrophobic constraints are under control, even though you have compositeness, and you have radiative stability until there. Okay, so that's the approach I'm taking. All right. However, logarithmically divergent terms are radiatively generated, which are not U4 invariant, okay, and which will contribute a mass to the pseudo Goldstones. And they take this form. Okay, this is allowed by the gauge interactions and by the Z2 symmetry, and it's not U4 invariant. Okay, and so this is this coefficient is of order this size, and the resulting mass for the pseudo Goldstones is easy to read off from this expression. It's of order this much, and if I'm interested in the Higgs as a strongly coupled composite, then the relationship between lambda and the symmetry breaking scale f, so the compositeness scale and the symmetry breaking scale is lambda is 4 pi f, and that's the limit I'm particularly interested in. So I get this expression for the Higgs mass parameter squared, and you can see it's two loop factors smaller than the cutoff squared. Okay, so the difference between the simple Goldstone model, which didn't work, this model, is that I get an extra factor of g squared over 16 pi squared. In other words, this is squared as opposed to coming with just one power. And then for a cutoff of order 5 TeV, the Higgs mass is weak scale size. So that's what you gain by doing it this way. So now that the flat direction has been lifted, we have to determine the vacuum alignment. Okay. So previously the Goldstone was exactly massless. So all points in the all directions in symmetry space were equivalent, right? All points in the vacuum manifold were equivalent. But since the flat direction has been lifted, now all directions are not equivalent, and we have to determine the vacuum alignment. So we do that by minimizing this potential. And what we find is that the web is split between the standard model Higgs and the twin Higgs. They both have equal webs. And the webs are of order F. Okay. So what we see here is that although the mass of the pseudo-Goldstone is small compared to F, the electroweak web is actually of order F. And in addition, the pseudo Goldstone is an equal mixture of the standard model Higgs and the twin Higgs. Okay. So now if I take the strong coupling limit and I set the web of R Higgs to 174 GeV, what I find for the cutoff, as I said, I'm interested in the compositeness limit. I do this naive scaling and I find that the cutoff is about 3 TeV. Okay. Now, so here's what I would like to do at this point. I would like to create a mild hierarchy between F and the web of the standard model Higgs that will allow me to raise this cutoff to be higher than 3 TeV, because remember, 3 TeV doesn't quite get around the positional electroweak constraints, okay? And which will allow and at the same time, it turns out that if the Higgs is an equal mixture of off, something with standard model quantum numbers and something which doesn't, that's also independently disfavored by positional electroweak. Okay? So I would also like the pseudo-Goldstone state to have quantum numbers more like the standard model Higgs. So how does one do that? So there are two possibilities which have been studied. Okay. So one approach is to add a term to the Higgs potential which softly breaks the twin symmetry. It breaks it softly because it has a mass dimension 2. And this was the approach we studied in our original paper and which was later studied by these others. And a term like this does not reintroduce quadratic divergence because it has mass dimension 2. And the values of mu much less than the cutoff are technically natural. Okay. So this approach allows you to generate the kind of mild hierarchy we need, but at the expense of mild fine-tuning. Okay. I will do it quantitatively, so just bear with me. Okay. The other approach is to extend the model by adding an extra Higgs doublet for both the standard model and the twin sector. In other words, instead of beginning with the standard model, begin with the two Higgs doublet standard model and just go through the same procedure I did. And it's then possible to generate a tree-level quadratic term for the pseudo-Goldstone without a corresponding mass term. And this allows you to generate this hierarchy more naturally. So this is a slightly technical point, but I will explain it further later on in the talk. Okay. So now let me come to the question which David asked. The discrete symmetry now has to be extended to all the interactions of the standard model. Okay. And this is where it gets challenging because, remember, you have this discrete symmetry. And since we know the masses of the standard model fermions, the discrete symmetry is telling you that whatever the twin fermions are, they have to have the same masses as the standard model fermions. Otherwise, the cancellation is not going to work. Okay. So there are two classes of models which have been constructed. In the first class of models, the twin fermions transform under mirror gauge groups. So you have a mirror copy of the standard model with exactly the same field content and interactions. And what the so we are identifying the discrete symmetry with parity. Okay. And what the parity symmetry does is it interchanges every standard model field with the corresponding field in the mirror standard model. And although the mirror fields are light, they have not been observed because they don't carry any charge under any of the standard model gauge groups. Okay. So that explains why we haven't seen the mirror fermions. I will discuss that too. Now those are completely valid questions, but I will of course come to them. The other approach is to again identify the discrete symmetry with parity, but this time realize it as left-right symmetry. So here the approach is, the twin fermions of the left-handed particles are the right-handed particles. So we have already seen the twin fermions. Okay, so there's nothing to explain there. All right. So but the gauge symmetry has to be extended to left-right symmetry, and parity symmetry is now exchanging all left-handed standard model fields with the corresponding right-handed fields. And these are the two possibilities that we have been able to come up with. And I don't know that these are the only ones, but so far this is what we have. So let me discuss the mirror model. Okay. So let's consider the mirror symmetric twin model in more detail. So this theory, again, predicts an entire light mirror standard model at low energies. And the mirror model, the mirror world is invisible to us because nothing transforms under the standard model gauge groups. And this idea was originally proposed way back by Li and Yang in their paper on parity evaluation of the weak interactions. So they suggested that this was one way to restore parity if you had a mirror world which was right-handed. Okay, so it's a very old idea.
No. I wanted to do that just because they wanted parity.
Well, I think they were just shocked, you know, just like everybody else, that parity was not a symmetry of nature. It was their attempt at atonement, you know. So gauge invariance allows only two renormalizable couplings between the standard model and the mirror standard model. And in fact, I couldn't trace any reference earlier than this in the around 1990, amazingly. So there's only two. There's this coupling, H mod HA squared mod HB squared, which is already part of the U4 invariant Higgs quartic. And there's this additional possibility, which mixes the photon and the mirror photon. So it's photon-mirror-photon mixing. So this quartic coupling is necessarily part of the theory. Now this photon-mirror-photon mixing is very tightly constrained by experiment. I'm going to set it to zero for now, and I'm going to come back to it. Okay. So now I'm going to focus on the case where the symmetry breaking pattern is realized non-linearly. Okay. And the advantage of doing this is to show that the low energy behavior I'm talking about is universal. It's independent of any specific ultraviolet completion. So it doesn't matter whether this is coming from strong dynamics or weak dynamics. I want to show you on the basis of this nonlinear model that the cancellation will work in any case. Okay. So I now parameterize this field H in this way, where the small HA are the nonlinear sigma model fields, okay, the Goldstone fields. And in particular, the first two components of H, H1 and H2, is the standard model Higgs field. Okay. And I'm going to assume that this theory has a cutoff which is less than or about a 4 pi f, where the upper bound is at strong coupling. Now, in general, this theory will contain arbitrary non-renormalizable operators suppressed by this k lambda. And previously in the linear model, it didn't make a difference whether I chose U4 or O8. I got 7 Goldstone bosons in either case. But now I'm going to break that degeneracy. I'm going to say that the symmetry is actually O8. Okay? And the reason is phenomenological. O8 contains custodial isospin, which is a symmetry of the standard model, and U4 doesn't. Okay.
So you really get a choice? I mean, doesn't U4 get in line with O8?
No. It's you can construct a theory of fermions which condenses U4 to U3, and the global symmetry is really U4. But
because it's fermion.
Exactly. It's a dumb reason. Okay. So I actually have not been able to get O8 to O7 actually. But this is okay. All right, so now let's look at the cancellation of quartic divergences in the nonlinear model. So here's the top sector. So this is the top Yukawa coupling for our sector, that's sector A, and this is for the twin sector. Now I rewrite HA and HB in terms of the nonlinear sigma model fields, and I get an interaction which is just the usual top Yukawa coupling. But I now get this strange non-renormalizable coupling of the standard model Higgs field to the mirror fermions. Okay. And now, when I look at the quartic divergences to the Higgs mass, here's the usual top loop with the top quark running around the loop. But I now have this additional contribution coming from this non-renormalizable interaction. Okay. And this vortex is proportional to the top Yukawa coupling. And there's also this chirality flip up here, which is also proportional to the top Yukawa coupling. And it turns out that when you do the calculation, the quartic divergences in these two diagrams cancel exactly. Okay. And that's a consequence of symmetry. And you kind of know it has to work that way. And it's nice to see that it does. Now, if you know something about little Higgs theories, the cancellation takes exactly the same form as in little Higgs theories. In other words, this diagram is exactly the same diagram as, for example, appears in the simplest little Higgs. Okay. But the crucial difference is that the states running in this loop, as opposed to little Higgs theories, the states running in this loop are not charged under standard model color. So this is the diagram which overturns the Fock theorem I talked about in the beginning. Okay. It's not right even in perturbation theory.
That's different. This shows that it's not right in strong coupling.
No, because a nonlinear signal model is true strong coupling or weak coupling, right? It's universal. That's the advantage of a nonlinear signal model. No, no, the point is that this gives you a very aggressively growing divergence, right? Because it's a non-renormalizable thing will give you something which tends to grow very quickly, right? And the point of a nonlinear sigma model is not that it's got something to do with strong coupling. A nonlinear sigma model is a universal parametrization of the Goldstone dynamics. So the things that come out of a nonlinear sigma model are independent of what the UV completion is. And this is why I chose this. So this cancellation will work both at strong coupling and at weak coupling. The difference is that the difference in the strong coupling limit is the relationship between the cutoff and F. The relationship that the cutoff is 4 pi F is a uniquely strong coupling limit. But everything else in this analysis can be taken over to both strong and weak coupling. Okay. The weak coupling, the way you do this is you integrate out the radial mode, and then you will generate this this nonlinear sigma model. Okay. All right. So the cancellation takes exactly the same form as in the Lil Higgs series, and one way to think about why this cancellation doesn't depend on color is that in these vertices are all top U cover vertices. They have nothing to do with color. And so color is simply a multiplicity factor of 3, because you have 3 quarks and you have 3 mirror quarks, and that's necessary, otherwise the cancellation wouldn't work. Now the cancellation of the gauge loops also takes the same form as in the Lil Higgs series. So you have the usual loop in the standard model. And there's a very similar looking loop, but instead of g squared out front, you actually have minus g squared. And so the cancellation is especially simple. Okay. So now let's work a bit harder and actually find the potential for the Higgs field. Okay. So any potential for the Higgs field can only arise from the interactions that break the O8 global symmetry. And in particular, the gauge and the Yukawa interactions. Now in the minimal model, the Higgs quartic is going to be generated radiatively from the top Yukawa coupling. So I'm not going to bother about that right now. Okay. I'll come to the model with the tree-level quartic later. So in order to obtain the Higgs potential, what we do is we minimize the Coleman-Weinberg effective potential. And since we have already verified the cancellation of quartic divergences, we know the resulting Higgs potential is only going to be logarithmically sensitive to the ultraviolet. Okay. And the answer is dominated by effects which arise from the top Yukawa coupling, which I'm going to balance against the mu squared term. You remember the term which softly broke the twin symmetry? I'm going to balance these two effects to obtain a realistic electroweak symmetry breaking. So, this is briefly what the results look like. So write the potential for the Higgs fields in this way. Okay. And so this is the same form as in the standard model, except there are higher order pieces here. The top Yukawa contribution to the Higgs mass parameter, this parameter, is given by this. And as expected, it's only logarithmically sensitive to lambda. And similarly, there's a contribution to this quartic. And that, of course, just by dimensional analysis can only depend logarithmically on lambda, and it's no surprise that it does. Okay. So it's these contributions which have to be balanced against those from the mu squared term to get electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay. So now, having computed the effective potential for the pseudo-Goldstone field, we are in a position to estimate the fine-tuning. So coming back to the question that Don asked. So here's for the minimal model. If I take a symmetry breaking scale F of 800 GeV and a cutoff of 10 TeV, I find the Higgs mass of order about 166 GeV and a fine-tuning of about 1 part in 10. And if I choose a lower value of F, 500 GeV, and a cutoff of about 6 TeV, now the Higgs mass is of order 150 GeV and the fine-tuning is about 1 in 3. Okay, so that's roughly what the fine-tuning is like. So you get at least an order of magnitude improvement over the standard model. So it doesn't completely remove the fine-tuning, but you do significantly better. And an important point here is that I'm allowed to take f this small, because position electroweak constraints in this theory are very weak. Okay, there are no particles charged under the standard model gauge groups. Okay, so most of the position electroweak bounds just go away from that, and the model has a custodial isospin symmetry because of the OH symmetry I began with. Yeah. I'll come back to it. Have faith. So what are the experimental constraints on the mirror model? So the most severe constraint, as Don pointed out, so now this has also died. I think I overuse these things. All right. That'll do for... So what are the experimental constraints of the mirror model? So the most severe constraint comes from cosmology, from requiring that the mirror states not contribute significantly to the energy of density of the universe at the time of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So, pardon? Well, that depends on how it's thermalized, right? And you could imagine a situation where our sector was thermalized differently from the mirror world.
So you're imagining a universe that started out with ordinary standard matter and no mirror matter.
What I'm going to go through the analysis and show you that assumption does not help. Okay. But I want to show you first that...
I'm just saying, when you talk about constraints,
Right, but what I'm going to show you is that the assumptions, that the results in some sense are not as sensitive to the initial conditions as you might think. But let me go through my analysis. I will come to your question.
And if, but before you,
So what I'm going to assume is that that at some point between an energy of a few GeV and a few MeV, our sector is there is some amount of entropy that's generated in our sector which is not generated in the mirror sector. Okay, I'm just going to assume that. Okay, and I'll motivate it a bit, but I'm not going to go any further than that. Okay, but let me first explain why. Because the thing is, suppose this thing was there. Okay, this means that this model, there would be no possible way it would be ruled out already. Okay, because what would happen is, right while BBN is going on, a standard model particle could spit out a photon which mixes with the mirror photon through this operator and thermalizes the mirror standard model. And if this epsilon is bigger than 10 raised to minus 9, this process will happen. Okay, there's no way to avoid it. It will happen right during BBN. And this model would be ruled out. Now what we showed is that if this parameter epsilon is initially zero, it's not generated up to four loops. Okay, this was a lot of work showing that this is not generated. Okay, we don't know. Okay, but the point is, if it's not generated up to three loops, it's already small enough that you get this bond, and it's actually not generated up to four. It's just approximate symmetries of the standard model, in the sense that you can show that if you try to generate it with just a few interactions in the standard model, those interactions always have enough symmetry that's enough to forbid this. So you have to have enough interactions. It's some kind of charge conjugation. It's a version of charge conjugation. Yeah. And So until you have enough vertices that you can, that the charge conjugation symmetry of the standard model is charge conjugation symmetry is broken, then this will not be generated. But that's right. But it's only not seen when you have enough. It's the combination of many vertices in the standard model that makes it not seen invariant. And so you have to have a loop diagram which involves all those C-violating vertices. And it turns out, and that's true in our sector and also in the mirror sector. And it's the combination of that which does it. Okay. But I actually drew all the diagrams by hand up to 3 loops and checked that it's not there. So I know it's not there. Well, you have to draw a graph. You have to draw a graph and remember, you got to do it on both sides, both our sector and the mirror sector, because it's really a flipping sign on either of them. So it's a combination of all these things which kills this.
What are the supernovae? Because this could also mimic the beginning of supernova with some mixing
quantities. I claim this will not work for the dimming of supernova for a reason which is completely different, which is if you dim the supernova this way, I claim that the microwave photons would have also been dimmed. So it would be ruled out based on that. Okay. But that's something, yeah. But anyway, I claim this constraint is in any case tighter. Okay. But I'm happy to discuss that with you. Yeah. But it's just I once thought about this independently in relation to supernova dimming. So I know it doesn't work for that.
But that's the thing with temperature, unlike the biological function, is different than the mirror.
No. What I'm assuming is for the dimming of supernova, what you'd assume is that the photons start out from the supernova, and then they oscillate into mirror photons that you don't see.
Right. Yeah.
And I claim that doesn't work, because the microwave background photons would have oscillated into mirror microwave background.
So there's also microwave mirror photons.
Okay. Oh, that's right, yeah, okay. I need different temperatures, yeah. All right. So the most severe constraint comes from this interaction, which is part of the U4 symmetric quartic. Okay. And this leads to mixing between the standard model Higgs and the twin Higgs once the Higgs fields get waves. So the light Higgs is a linear combination of the two Higgs fields. And what this interaction does is it keeps the mirror sector in thermal equilibrium with the standard model until temperatures of order 5 GeV. Okay. So that's, again, unavoidable. You can't avoid it. Okay. Unless the reheat temperature, for whatever reason, is below 5 GeV. So to escape experimental bounds, we require that between this temperature and 5 MeV, when the weak interactions decouple, some entropy is added to the standard model sector, but not to the mirror sector. Okay. So I'm going to give you two of the possibilities. So one is you have some a brief epoch of late inflation, which is followed by reheating. And at the end of inflation, our sector is reheated more efficiently than the mirror sector. Okay, so the reheating temperature has to be between these two values. Okay. That's possible to arrange. People have done that. The thing is to have something like a parity odd state in the theory, and people have been able to do this. Okay. Well, the reheating temperature actually depends on the coupling between. It doesn't just depend on the scale at which inflation happens. It also depends on the coupling of the inflaton to the two sectors, right?
So
I think so. Yeah, provided the coupling is small enough. Yeah. Yeah, that would be a problem. Yeah, if yeah.
I still don't understand. I mean, if it's a mirror copy of the standard model, why would these things look different? Can you explain why the entropy would look different in different temperature ranges?
Well, our entropy is more efficient. How do you explain that?
So you have to construct an inflaton potential, right? Which spontaneously. It could be symmetric, but it would spontaneously break the symmetry in such a way that one side is here. So it's but people have done it. I didn't do it, so I didn't put it here. But there's a paper by Mohapatra and maybe Berejiani in which they look at things like this. So this is doable. Okay. But that's quite a lot time before my work. So all right, the other possibility is that. Remember, I created this hierarchy between F and V. So the number of light quarks in the standard model is different from the number of light quarks in the mirror world. So the other possibility is that the QCD phase transition in the standard model generates more entropy than the QCD phase transition in the mirror sector. And so so our world is heated more efficiently below 5 dB. So that's the other possibility. So I asked some lattice people. And what they told me is that it's true that if you have three light quarks, the phase transition in the standard model is likely first order. And if you have two light quarks, it's lower order. But the issue at stake is whether the strange quark is considered light for the point of view of the QCD phase transition. And even though the issue isn't settled yet, it could be that it has to be heavy, in which case this wouldn't work. But the final issue is still out.
Sir, what is this?
Do you know
the same
phase
in the mirror sector?
No, the mirror sector, remember, I softly broke the right? So that means that the revs of the two Higgses are not the same. So now so now you have two light quarks in one sector and three in the other, right? So that's the thing. Okay. All right. So how do you test this class of models at colliders? Now this is difficult because the new states are not charged under the standard model gauge groups. The standard model communicates with the mirror world only through the Higgs. Okay. So one possibility is to look for invisible decays of the standard model Higgs into mirror states. So we expect this to occur between 5% and 50% of the time, depending on the value of the symmetry breaking scale F. But that's provided the decay of the Higgs to 2Ws is kinematically forbidden. Okay. If this decay channel is open, the Higgs will decay 100% of the time into W plus W minus. And so that's the worst case scenario for the LHC because an understanding of electroweak symmetry breaking would then not be possible. Okay. You would just see something that looks like a standard model Higgs and just nothing else. Okay. The invisible decays would be through the mixing of the Higgs with the mirror Higgs, which then goes to mirror Bs. But this would be swamped if the decay of the Higgs to W plus W minus was open. All right. Now in this scenario, mirror baryons constitute some or all of the dark matter. And it's very...
If you went to the small quantum event and construct a cosmology, for chance,
not the...
much less matter than the mirror sector.
I say some or all of the dark matter. I mean,
dark matter, because dark matter indeed doesn't clump. And if you have a mirror strong
interaction with the baryons, it'll form stars. Actually, if you go and look on spires, there's God knows how many papers on mirror dark matter.
Okay.
Okay. So no. Look. Okay. Look, for example, let me show you one simple.
Matter does not have. Look at those pictures after they were shown. Dark matter halos. They're not clumped.
See, a large part of the clumping, right, is due to the emission of photons, right? But here's the thing. Now let's say that I already put in some explicit soft breaking to the theory, right? But it's almost impossible to generate soft breaking without some amount of hard breaking, just by dimensional analysis. Okay. Now the difference in you cover couplings between the up quark and the down quark is very, very small. So let's say that the soft breaking, that the amount of breaking the theory becomes a hard breaking in the Yukawa couplings of the small of the light quarks, so that the neutron is lighter than the proton, for example. So now you could imagine a scenario where most of the dark matter is neutrons, which don't communicate with the photon, and which therefore don't radiate. Okay. But you know, like I said, you know, there is, you know, I looked on spires. There's no end to the papers and no end to the possibilities, and people see things in all kinds of ways. I'm saying a very conservative thing. All I'm saying is it constitutes some or all of the dark matter. I don't know. Where some could be negligible. Okay, as far as I'm concerned. All right. I don't have much time. I'm running a bit short of time. So let me skip this, and if there's time, I'll come back to it. So let me go right to the left-right model. So take a brief look at the left-right symmetric twin Higgs model. So now what I do is I extend the gauge group to SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 B minus L. So this was studied a long time ago by Patti and Salam, and later by Malpatra and Sinjanovic. So now the field H, which breaks the U4 symmetry, now consists of an SU2L doublet and an SU2R doublet. Okay. And parity symmetry guarantees that the gauge coupling strength of SU2 left is equal to that of SU2 right. And also that the Yukawa couplings of the left-handed Higgs are equal to those of the right-handed Higgs. Then the dimensionful terms in this potential for H will again be U4 invariant. And you can go through exactly the same argument. And the web of this right-handed Higgs is going to break SU2R cross U1B minus L to hypercharge. Okay. The field HL, which corresponds to the standard model Higgs, emerges as the pseudo-Goldstone boson of the broken U4, just like before. Now, the standard model fermions have these quantum numbers under SU2L cross SU2R cross U1B minus L. And this is the same in any left-right model. It's the usual choice of quantum numbers. And the light fermions acquire masses through non-renormalizable operators. These operators respect the discrete parity symmetry, so they don't generate quadratic divergences. But since the top Yukawa is order 1, to generate it, you introduce these additional fermions with these quantum numbers. And you can then write a left-right symmetric top Yukawa coupling in this form. Okay. Now, because the bounds on right-handed Higgs bosons right-handed gauge bosons are quite tight, you also have to extend the Higgs sector to avoid the experimental constraints. Okay. And I'm not showing that, but you have to add one extra pair of HL and HR. So finally, the predictions of this theory are right-handed gauge bosons, these vector-like quarks that I added, and a natural dark matter candidate, which is something from the Higgs sector. And this model is promising for the LHC. So the heavy Z can be the right-handed Z can be observed through these kind of Drellian processes. So you have quark anti-quark going through the heavy Z to E plus E minus, and you'll see a big jump in the cross section to E plus E minus at the mass of this new state. So you see this nice big bump, and so this should be relatively straightforward to see at the LHC. So what about the vector-like quarks? These can also be produced. This analysis was done by Go, who's a postdoc at Arizona, and my colleague Shufang Su. So the heavy top partners can also be produced, and the dominant decay production mechanism is through you first produce the heavy W, which decays into the top partner and a B. Okay. So then the question is, can you identify this top partner? And it turns out that in large regions of parameter space, these top partners decay to three B jets, a lepton, and missing energy. Okay. And it may be possible to reconstruct these events. It may not be that easy, but it may be possible. And the reason is that every decay in this chain is a two-body decay. So it's kinematically fairly constrained. And on top of that, every decay here occurs with almost 100% probability. So if you do produce this thing, this is the kind of cascade you'll get. And you may have enough events, and given the kinematic constraints, you may be able to work backwards and reconstruct this this heavy top partner. All right, so let me conclude. So twin Higgs theories are a new way of realizing the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone and stabilizing the weak scale without large corrections to positional electroweak observables. The existing models are based on parity symmetry. They are realized either as mirror symmetry or as left-right symmetry. And the two cases have completely different phenomenology. So what these theories show is that canceling quadratic divergences to the Higgs mass parameter does not necessarily require new particles charged under the standard model gauge groups. Okay. And I think another lesson to take from here is naturalness doesn't automatically imply that new physics will be easy to see at the LHC. In fact, I would go so far as to say that even if the LHC doesn't find new physics, naturalness would not have been disproven. Okay. And the next step is to find ultraviolet completions for these models. In other words, to find, for example, composite Higgs models where this kind of pattern of symmetry breaking occurs naturally. And people have constructed weakly coupled at supersymmetric ultraviolet completions, but up to now there hasn't been a strongly coupled composite ultraviolet completion. But thank you. But at scales beyond the reach of the LHC. So at low energies, you wouldn't see supersymmetry. Yeah.
Is the supersymmetric you need completion without or with time implication?
Yes. Well, I have to be careful. There's two. And in the mirror one, it is.
Yeah.
And in the left-right one, it's not. Yeah, that's the story.
Thanks,
yeah.